ChatGPT wasn't released until 2022. And it was quite intentional because ChatGPT, the original free version, isn't massively powerful, but they purposely released it to prepare people.
Welcome to the Oh For Food's Sake podcast, where we unwrap the joys and struggles of working in the food industry so you can thrive in what you do best while sustaining a rewarding and fulfilling career or business. We are your hosts, Lucy Wager, food industry consultant,
and Amy Wilkinson, food industry coach. We've worked in the food industry for the last 20 years, and we're here to share with you the benefit of our hindsight. Our podcast is for you to find new ways to cope with the daily struggles, but mostly to inspire you to work on what's not working to ultimately improve your career or business long term.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Oh For Food's Sake. We have got two guests with us today. Welcome to the podcast to Claire Ostridge, Director, and Cara Webb, Head of Digital Innovation and Research Technology at Grounded Research, formerly England Marketing. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lucy. Hello.
And congratulations on your rebrand as well. So formerly England Marketing and now Grounded Research.
Yes. So we've been England Marketing for about 30 years and it seemed like a good time to change given we're coming into our 30s now. Everything starts to get a bit more serious. It's time for a...
It's when you get, properly realise you're a grown up, right? When you're in your 30s.
Yeah, I think so. And it's kind of, you know, what happened in our 20s when we first started as England Marketing. Marketing was very different. There was no such thing as the internet quite so much as it was in 1994. And we do a lot more research than we do marketing now. So it made sense. And we went for Grounded for three reasons. Grounded because it makes sense given that we work across the agri-food supply chain. Grounded because Grounded Insight is a sort of theory and research. And Grounded again because we're quite grounded, sleeves rolled up type of people. We like to think so.
It's a clever name. So welcome to the podcast. Tell us a bit more about you and the history of the business. And then the purpose of getting you onto the episode is because we want to talk about AI in research, specifically for the food industry, because it's something that we've worked on together and AI is really topical. But before we get into that really interesting meaty bit, tell us about the business and a bit more about yourselves as well.
Sure. So England Marketing, as it formerly was, has been going for 30 years. It was actually established by my mum, and it was all about, she's a farmer's wife and she wanted something that fit flexibly, mainly around childcare, funnily enough. So it's sort of, I've always grown up with it as sort of my younger, more irritating sibling that got all the attention. I joined the business 3 years ago, having done nearly 10-15 years in marketing as sort of branding and all the sort of what I perceived to be the pretty side. Joined during the pandemic because I was on mat leave, everyone got furloughed and she needed a hand. Since then, completely fallen in love with research. We've been doing food and farming research, like I said, for 30 years, but it's really accelerated what we're doing with my digital marketing background. We took Cara on. I wouldn't say we poached Cara because...
did you work together before?
Cara was at the university where we were doing some galvanic skin response studies with apples to see if there was a sort of emotional reaction to eating different apples as a differentiator. So there's a bit of a technical foodie side. And next thing I knew, she had all these skills, so came into business. She's the most qualified person I know. If we have to ever submit CVs and things, Cara's kind of, could you just send me over that document as a compressed document, please?
Oh, really? Flattery will get you everywhere, Claire.
I haven't told you about a brief that came in this morning, that's why. So we've just kind of taken the business forward. We've really embraced AI adoption with Cara's experience in that field. We've always done consumer research where we need technical support. We have a whole network of food scientists, production scientists, and supply chain consultants that we pull in. And it's really, we kind of form the core team and the project management element of it. During COVID, we built our own consumer panel, which is sort of now 10,000 people and growing. So if anyone wants to join in with some at-home taste testing or on-site taste testing, please do look us up and join. We built a farmer panel of 600 farmers to really get that end-to-end supply chain understanding and opinion piece. And just using all of the tech and a lot of AI to make, ironically, given it's AI, but make research more human and make it more natural. So using technology. So that's kind of where we're going, where we're heading. So it's a really interesting place to be, particularly on how you can use it for the food industry.
Yeah, really,
it's really exciting, isn't it? And it's funny because Amy and I have been talking for a while saying, oh, we really ought to do an episode on AI and how you can use it to your advantage working in food. And, you know, we both use ChatGPT for different things, but we're not like, you know, mega AI users. And so when I obviously called you about a client that I was working with and we're doing some development work and he wanted to do some research, I said, oh, I definitely know who I can put you in touch with. And then we had a chat and that's when you mentioned AI and I was like, oh, wow, this sounds really good. And we have, you know, I've been lucky enough to be involved in this research involving the AI. And so that's why I said to Amy, we have to get Claire and Carol on to talk about AI and how you can use it. Because I think when anybody starts using AI, it's like, wow, this is like, it's so powerful. But equally, there's so many questions about it. And particularly when you're using it in this way, where there's money involved, you know, it's new and it can feel a bit scary, can't it? And the unknown.
I think one of the interesting things that I always think back, so like my background was initially in human sciences, and then I taught psychology for about 10 years and then went into research technology in various universities. So my focus was mainly on psychophysics. So how can we accurately measure people doing things with the available technology and ensure that's all accurate. My involvement in AI began around about 2006. So in my master's, I did some stuff on neural networking, which is kind of like the fundamental building blocks of artificial intelligence that we see today. But I think it feels new. So I recently went to a developer meeting with Sam Altman as the chair who is the CEO of OpenAI. And in these conversations that we were having, it was very intentional that they released ChatGPT when they did, because OpenAI has had these models probably since around 2015, 2016. The original GPT-3 model was released in 2020, whereas ChatGPT wasn't released until 2022. And it was quite intentional because ChatGPT, the original free version, isn't massively powerful, but they purposely released it to prepare people because things are going to change. And those were his own words. You know, it was very intentional. We released this model. They also use it for a very specific form of training. It's not necessarily taking your data, but there's a very specific form of fine tuning called RHLF, which is reinforcement human-led feedback. So that's one of the ways they make their models better. They get you to interact with it, and then they ask you, is this good? Is this bad? And then they can fine tune their models for something called super alignment. And so all super alignment is, they use lots of big words, but all it really means is getting AI to do the things we want to do reliably. So it feels very new, but these algorithms and machine learning algorithms permeate our lives on a daily basis. Everything from targeted advertising is all machine learning based. Security for your logins to your bank and fraudulent things, all of that is monitored using AI. And this is kind of interchangeable things. So in AI, we'd probably refer to these things as machine learning algorithms, in that they are algorithms or patterns that have learned things and to do jobs. So it could be something as simple as, you know, self-driving cars. They use a huge amount of machine learning algorithms to identify hazards. I think what ChatGPT brought us was something that was very, very easy to interact on a everyday basis, which really kind of, you know, sparks the imagination. It's very human-like.
I was going to say it brings into the people, whereas before you had to code and you all sorts of things.
You had to be a tech person to get it.
It's just like using Google. But
do you know what scares me? Not scares me, but you know, like you're saying, oh, it's like
ChatGPT is not that powerful. Like when me and Lucy discovered it, so last year we were like, oh my God, this is changing our lives. I mean, it's changed the podcast for us as well, hasn't it? Because it helps us speed up the process of loads of things that we do with the podcast. So like, it's massively powerful. And you're telling us that this is the bit that they've just put out there to get us ready.
She's trying to make you feel better, Amy, by saying, you know, we've all been living with this for so long. It's okay, guys. It's not scary.
No.
By powerful, I think I'm more referring to things such as their paid for version has the ability to interact with other services, which makes it far more powerful. So it can interact with the internet. It accepts multimodal inputs and outputs, so you can give it pictures. One of the really nice things that I'm kind of playing with at the moment, and it is just a bit sort of a fun, taking pictures and of maybe ingredients that you have got in your fridge, just like these are all the rubbish that I've got left over at the end of the month. I don't know what to do with it. Take a picture of it, pop it to ChatGPT, ask for a recipe. You know, things like that, those kind of pipelines when it can have multimodal things like vision and stuff like that. And then on top of that, we use the API, and what an API is, it allows us to programmatically interact with the model directly. So you might go to ChatGPT, it's got a nice interface and things like that. Pretty much for all our work, we use the API, and we've got access to some of the preview versions. So they have bigger contexts, so you can give it a lot more information. So the free version, you can give it probably about 3,000 words as context. The models we're working with have 128K context. So that's about 100,000 words that we can provide it as context. So we can give it the data and ask it to perform functions on that. So as we move towards more powerful models, I don't necessarily think they will get better with language, but there's a couple of things that they really lack: long-term memory, which is a big challenge, and something to replicate the mirror neurons, i.e. give it some kind of empathy or emotional sort of ability to recognize emotion. But that's all in super alignment and safety and things like that. So the ultimate goal, I think, for companies like OpenAI is AGI, so artificial general intelligence, which is a catch-all AI that can do everything as well as or better than humans. Okay, so at the moment we kind of silo things. If you want something to diagnose cancer cells, for example, you would have a very specific AI to do that. You'd train it to focus on that. Whereas, you know, ChatGPT, the free version, is probably a pre-AGI. You know, it's like a little baby AGI, a little toddler almost. It hasn't quite developed its neural networks to a point where it can kind of do something confidently like we can as adults.
So we've got a good 6 months till it takes over the world, in other words.
Yeah. Although I listened to that podcast that the guy who left Google did with Stephen Bartlett, where he was like predicting that like there was going to be this like Armageddon situation. Well, he didn't know what was going to come in, but he was like, AI is going to take over. And that was months ago, and nothing's really happened as far as I know. And then, this is a little bit left field, but I listened to another podcast, and it was about how the instability in the world, there's one factory in Taiwan that produces the most complex AI chip, literally one factory. And if that goes, it's going to set everything back anyway.
So I guess in response to a couple of things with that, humans have always been the biggest risk to humans.
Unquestionably.
And still are and always probably will be. So at the moment, what we do to train an AI in relation to those chips, so Joe Biden recently signed the chips like policy, I don't know what they call it in America, to actually move some of that manufacturing to the US. OpenAI has been looking at hardware specific chips, mainly from, I think, Dubai in the Middle East. So there is an attempt to move some of those chips to more manufacturers. And at the moment, we use GPUs to train AI, so graphic processing units, and mainly gaming GPUs, because they're very, very good. Graphics are very complicated. Light is very complicated, and how it interacts with things. So to make things look realistic, Quite often we use these GPUs in gaming systems because they're very good at doing really complex math really quickly, which is perfect for training an AI. You are doing very complex math and you want it to happen very quickly. So I think in terms of what you're saying is it's probably related to the GPU chips. So, you know, those graphic processing units, and there is a shortage. And previously there was a shortage because of cryptocurrency mining and no one could buy any gaming because, again, hashing algorithms for mining is complex maths, and training AIs is complex maths. So Google have racks of these GPUs, very, very powerful, very, very expensive, that they utilize to train these GPUs. So definitely
mind-blowing.
They're moving towards pure AI. So once we get AI chips that are focused, not like hijacked GPUs for gaming, then the training process will be cheaper, it will be more efficient, and it will be less energy intensive, because that's the other thing at the moment. Every interaction you have with an LLM, roughly estimated, is the same as leaving like an LED light bulb on for 1 hour. And, you know, there's millions of people interacting with these models and things like that. But it's normally training that's the big power drain. It's very energy intensive and things like that.
But we're sort of on the precipice of it. Like, it's almost like it's going to scale, because if they can make those components like cheaper, easier, quicker, then it's going to scale.
And that's the thing. But when an interesting thing that I also heard is it's not AI that's going to take over. It's the humans that utilize AI that are going to take over. And that's what gets me excited about it, because when Claire was like, "Oh, we use AI," I was like, "This is amazing! I want to use it for good." Yeah, I want to be in Claire's club because she's already using AI. So let's, you know. So tell us a little bit about how, and obviously, and I know a bit of this, but let's talk about how we've been using it, Claire, because this is what's exciting for food businesses. I think it's really interesting getting that background from somebody that really understands AI, because it is like totally over my head. But then I've been interacting with the chatbot with what we've done, and suddenly I love it. You know, that's real to me. I don't understand how it's done.
A lot of the kind of challenge of it is what can you use it for? So it's the use case element. And, you know, it's really great to know that it exists and interact with it on, you know, just playing with some ChatGPT questions. But actually, when you have a use case like we've developed for it, Lucy, with MPD development, keep trying to make it more human as a way of using respondents to research, essentially, make it more human and get more out of them. So where I think one of the key elements for using AI, particularly in food and drink industry and innovation development, is I think there's that Mintel study that said innovation was down 18%. Don't quote me on my figures though, because I read it a while ago. But I think innovation and the shock of the new, and how do we attract consumers, and how do we continue doing that even though resources are sort of finite and we're all looking at different pressures and things. Using AI to understand them better and what they will then respond to is essential, really. So back in the old days of food and drink research, and we do still use it, we're just using it in a better way. You'd have your surveys, I mean, even going back to the really old days, on paper, and we would then transcribe what people wrote down on paper. We use tablets now. So we've got a tasting studio and viewing gallery and everything else. So we can do all sorts of fun things, but essentially the problem that we had was that you were biasing people and funneling them down to answer questions that you wanted to know. Not just that, but you're asking them questions on a Likert scale, which is that 1 to 5, which is fine because that's, you know, it's a standard practice of research, tried, tested method, it does get results. But ultimately, if they love it or hate it, they're going to give it a 1 or a 5. If they're a bit meh, it's okay, they'll give it a 2 or a 4. Or they might be really annoying and sit bang down the middle. Looking at all those stats together, you can kind of get some good ideas and some thoughts around what direction you might want that product to go in. But what it doesn't do is connect the human with your product. It doesn't give them an opportunity to express themselves. And where we've used AI to do that is because it's got this massive processing capacity and it can take what somebody says, either as a voice note, a video, text. We can do facial recognition. We can look at things like tone and voice inflections. Cara, jump in when it gets technical. and we can start to pull together a much more human picture We can do it. We don't have to get them into a taste testing studio. It's something that they can do at home. They can. Everyone's, you know, got a computer in their pockets now. They can film themselves doing things. So we started this just as a give us some text feedback, expecting that they'd tell us a bit. We didn't expect full cookbooks of recipes, I don't think, Lucy, and how they cooked it, what they cooked it with, you know, where their trials and tribulations were. You could get a sense of where their frustrations really sat, because it was an open field. It was almost like having a conversation. What's the problem with this product? What could we do better? And it's not kind of saying, how do you rate the taste on a scale of 1 to 10? How do you rate the texture?
I think you highlight, especially from a research methods perspective, to me, this is GPTs are large language models. They are experts at language. So using their expertise in language to kind of scale qualitative research is really kind of what we've done. But we're very conscious about lots of things. So we tend to use it in triangulation with quant. It means, like, as a micro enterprise, I guess, as a smaller business, it's like adding 10 people. We can create AI agents to perform certain tasks for us very, very specifically. So we do a lot of thematic analysis using the GPTs. We use another API endpoint called Hume, which, like Claire says, allows us to do the emotional interpretation from facial expressions. And that kind of negates those demand characteristics that you have in a survey. So, you know, people always want to either be good, you know, they're trying to figure out, what do they want from me? I want to give the right answer. Or they're the opposite. Mm. Like, this survey sucks. I hate you all.
You were testing it on me, Cara. Yeah. And it made me laugh because Cara would, recording without my consent, but it's internal, so it's okay. And she'd say, which project do you think you were talking about? Here's the output. And it would kind of be a visual, all the emotions.
Cool. I mean, like, this is going to, like, change law enforcement. That's an American term, because I've listened to too many true crime podcasts that are American. But you know what I mean? Because it's like people aren't going to be able to lie anymore.
Well, this is the caveat with things like that. So when, as part of sort of, I was a chartered psychologist. Well, I still am a chartered psychologist. And when we're looking at lie detecting, it's horrifically unreliable. FBI-trained agents can elude any kind of lying detectors and stuff like that. But what it will transform in policing is the pipeline and accuracy of data. And I think they're looking at this right now. So if you send your police out with body cams and it records everything, you can then process that video directly for an AI. You always have a human in the loop. You know, we're not trusting the AI. It's the recommended way. We have a human in the loop. So by the time they get back to the station, that video is recorded in a report, and they have to read through it and, you know, kind of approve it for accuracy. And I think that's where we're going to get those marginal gains.
And that's it. It's speeding things up, because the thing that I have found, can we skip to the bit where I tell you how I've used it? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Go on then.
Because what I have found really useful, it's that reflective bit as well. So say we had done a survey and we'd also done a consumer panel, and then me and my client would be reflecting on all the information that we've received. We've read through the reports. We might have sat in the consumer panel, and then you inevitably will make changes to the product. You'll discuss those internally. You'll talk about, okay, well, what if we did this? And you sort of start talking hypothetically. And this is exactly what we did yesterday. And we started talking about something new that we hadn't considered before. And I was like, oh, I wonder if there was anything that came up in that. So then I asked the chatbot, did anybody mention this particular thing? I can't even remember what it was. It was about weight or something, or cooking time or something like that. Did anybody? And then it was like, just checking my data. So you sit there like, what's it gonna come up? And then it says, yes, there were several comments about this throughout the research. And then it details. So it's like you are then, like, sat with those people that did the research for you.
And asking them again the question you want to know.
This was weeks ago. And it's, from a product development perspective, that is so incredibly useful, because to go back and be able to reflect on with people that have actually tried those products in their homes, cooking them as they would. And for me, as a product development consultant, especially working with startups, where there can be quite a lot of emotion and personal feelings involved, it can bring you back to reality and be like, well, actually, we've got a consumer that agrees with this, or no, I think we should go down this way, or actually nobody even mentioned it. So what does that mean? What does that mean if nobody even brought it up and saw it as a...
That's the thing. I think it's really important to let them sort of spout forth. Don't poke them down survey responses.
Yeah.
Let them say what they think, feel, do, act. Let them just say it however they want to say it, because then you know it's not been prompted. You know, obviously we get training in how to make sure that questions aren't leading or biased. But if you're not using a market research agency and you're just going out, do you like this? You know, even by asking them the question, even by the fact that they are the people that are responding to you rather than running in the opposite direction in Tesco's, means that they are biased in some way. So you've got to, this really allows us to reduce that right down and let people take part in a way that is more human.
Before we go any further, we want to extend our gratitude to our sponsors, Damer Ingredients. Their ongoing support behind the scenes is helping us build a vibrant community through this podcast.
Working with Damer on various projects, both for my own brand and my clients, has been an eye-opener. Their vast technical expertise not only saves time and money, but it also adds a layer of depth to the product development process.
And my commercial head likes the fact that by holding stock in the UK, they can be quick to react and flexible with quantities, which makes it lower risk post-launch as well. To find out more, visit www.damer.com.
In the food industry, the fear of product recalls and food safety issues is ever present. The wait for listeria test results can be stressful and time-consuming. But thanks to our sponsor, Nemis Technologies, there's a breakthrough with Nemis's N-Light Rapid Listeria Monocytogenes test. You can get accurate listeria results in just 24 hours. To find out more, visit nemistech.com. That's nemistech.com.
I was also thinking about the bias of the person interpreting it as well, because I'm just thinking about your clients, Lucy, the ones that are like really passionate and want to hear what they want to hear, because that happens, doesn't it? It's like, oh, can you, like almost they want you to ask the question in a way that reaffirms what they...
We get it. Researcher bias. Yeah. And it's so hard in focus groups if you're really passionate, especially about food, and you love the product, not to nod along going, that's really good.
I think, certainly for some of our projects, we still maybe suggest areas to consider in things like that, because I think the average consumer certainly, I come from a background that is not food at all. Like, food tastes good or bad to me, and that's the kind of feedback that you're going to get from
me. But you know what?
Food's good.
But this is the thing though, isn't it? Because I think because we are foodies and we're so close to it, because we were having that, I remember having that conversation with Mark Worley, and it's like because we were always talking about needs and the consumer, the need is I'm hungry and I want it now. And we're all like, it's because of this and it's because of that. It's like, no, that's your inflated ego. It's not because of any of those things.
90% of... Over 90% of the choice, when you're faced with a supermarket shop, supermarket aisle, whatever SKU you're looking at, 90% of the choice, you're going in and you will choose in that moment. And it's not because of any clever, fancy marketing thing or anything else. The problem that I think that we get to with the food testing and the NPD development is how can we make it so good that they've made that choice before they get to the SKU?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bit, it's the repeat purchase. Let the marketers do their thing on getting people picking it up and putting it in their trolley. The repeat purchase is where NPD comes in. And that's where, if you don't have repeat purchase, you can pretty much knock your product ideas and dreams on the head, because there's going to be no one buying it. So that's where this comes in. And it's so important, the work you're doing, Lucy, with developing a product and making it better, how we can input with that and giving the consumer a real voice, not just asking them the questions we want to hear.
Yeah, and at this point, I think it's also really important, because I remember the first conversation we had about this, I was like, oh, this is going to be too expensive. It's going to be too expensive. And it's not, because it's AI. Like, the other benefit of AI is it's so bloody clever and quick that it's so...
It's affordable.
You know,
I think
it's affordable.
It's the fact it's affordable.
So it's like we're entering this new dimension of like incredible information that isn't prohibitively expensive.
Yeah. I mean, if you had said, Lucy, we'd like to look at 60 people and we want them all to have open-ended survey results And you need to analyze them without AI, which some public sectors still ask us if we would do, and it jumps the budget up enormously. But that would take a team of researchers code framing everything, checking against the code frames, having another researcher come in and again check your work. That is where the cost racks up. And because these the LLMs, it means that you can, with a degree of accuracy, know that they are, as you know, they're a lot better than me at language interpretation.
I think they're standardized as well. You know, you kind of, you know, when you're coding and doing things like that, an LLM doesn't suffer from fatigue. It doesn't suffer from boredom. Can I just,
what is LLM?
It's a large language model. So ChatGPT is a lot, has, well, GPT is a large language model. There's a few others, like Google Bard is a large language model, and Meta have a version, so Facebook and Instagram, called Llama as well. But they're not as, the most accurate one out there in terms of accuracy, hallucinations, and super alignment really is GPT-4.
Do you want to say what hallucinations are?
I think, so I'm not really certain where the term hallucination came from, but, and I've just written an article for it that I think is going to go out on our website at some point if you, you know, if people want to read more about it. Hallucinations are where LLMs say something incorrect but incredibly confidently.
And that like is a middle-aged white man.
Bullshit is in a meeting.
The reason it does this is all down to its architecture and kind of how it works. So like, do poke me if I get a bit technical, but we collect lots of data to train these models. And it's a very specific, it's basically a complex set of maths called a generative pre-trained transformer, or a GPT. We give it lots of data and it learns in an unsupervised manner. So we don't have to tell it what answers are correct and what are wrong. And all it's doing is learning to predict statistically the most likely next word. That's all these LML, the large language models are, really. They are statistical models of human language. So if I said to you, the cat is sat on the, or instantly you're thinking Matt, I can imagine. If I was to say the cat is sat on the BMW, that does make sense. But in language, as in when we generally use it, it's statistically infrequent. So it's less likely to happen. And this is where we get something called token prediction, which is really what these, how they work. I'm simplifying it because they are insanely complex. We're talking 180 billion different parameters on GPT-4.
That's why it's better than me.
And what it's trying to do.
I don't have that many parameters.
And what it's trying to do is predict essentially what you want it to say. It's trying to predict it. So a good example, I work in education as well. And a lot of students, when they got hold of this, they started generating their essays and it would make fake references to papers that just didn't exist. But what it has learned to do is to predict what kind of the words should look like. So these fake papers look legitimate because it knows the format of how papers are generally named, the kind of names that are involved, the years, and how to sort of present it. And it confidently just goes, yes, by all means, here's a paper. And it just doesn't exist because of the way it is trained.
Funnily enough, though, Cara, sorry to just interject on that. Even when I was, I just recently did an MRS qualification, and all I wanted it to do was put the bibliography that I'd just been dumping my references in the end. I copied and pasted it in, and I said, could you just put it in the format of the Harvard referencing model? And it took what I had, and it still made up an extra one in there, and I was
did it.
So
that's really interesting, though. Actually really, it is not necessarily truth, whatever it comes up with.
Yeah, you have to be the most efficient way to use AI tools is, you are the expert human in the loop. So we have to do this thing in programming called rejects. And it's one of the worst things you have to do. You have to, if you want to take the brackets out of a sentence, you've got to figure out the pattern and things like that. And it used to take ages and I hated it. But now ChatGPT can do it really quickly. And I can look at it and go, yeah, that works. Interestingly enough, there's been some research, and I can link this to you. The hallucination rate on GPT-4 is about 3%. It's the best model we've ever had, compared to about 86. So the accuracy of the free version is about 86%. And this is all down to RHLF, which is fine tuning. So when GPT,
what's RHLF?
That is reinforcement, human led reinforcement learning. So when you give it feedback about the answers, it fine tunes the model.
I know.
And I am very conscious.
But it's good because these things that come up all the time, and that, you know, I know it's quite technical, but it's good to have these things. Do you think that 100% of everybody listening is going to know what ChatGPT is? And I'm asking this because, like, my husband doesn't use it. He's like a bit of a dinosaur. He doesn't use it, doesn't want to really know about it. Like, only knows about it because I talked to him about it.
The challenge is lots of organizations won't let you use it because there is a concern that you're putting in company data or commercially sensitive data that it will then learn on.
I couldn't use it the other day when I was at a retailer before that.
So I've worked as a beta tester with OpenAI for probably about 5 or 6 years now. And I think it's just a case of being very conscious and having OpenAI are super accommodating. You can have conversations with them about your data security. So the models and the account that we have, none of our data, we have an enterprise account. So none of our data is used in training and it is removed after 30 days. And it uses industry standard encryption supplied by Microsoft. So the free version is a research version. They are quite open to say, we will use this data. This is why it's free, because it's costing us the millions per month to run it. So, like, obviously be cautious, but if you do have, if you do want to use those kind of things in your organization, it is as simple as having opening communications with the model providers. Very accommodating. They want you to use their models. And there are secure ways to do it as long as you're kind of mindful. In terms of the exposure of ChatGPT and people using it, it's going to become embedded in the majority of the Microsoft applications that you use. So Windows 11 will get Copilot, which is they're kind of going to come in and
is sort this of Clippy coming back?
Kind of. and Office 365 is also introducing Copilot. So us programmers at the moment have Copilot when we program, as in it's a GPT that is in our software that helps us to build things. But that is coming universally to normal applications that you have. So they're making it more accessible for users who maybe don't want to engage with that sort of thing. And I mean, it's already quite prevalent in a lot of things. You go into something like Canva, you can use their AI.
Yeah, everything comes up with six fingers, Cara.
So generative image, and it works in a completely different way as well. So we're kind of only really talking about text at the moment. So image things will get better. It's just very risky. And how you manage the safety and super alignment of imagery is kind of challenging. And hands are very difficult. We overestimate how
challenging.
I did A-level. Have you ever tried to draw a hand yourself? Because I'm rubbish at it. They're always like this.
About the kind of AI assistance though, Amy, I listen to the podcast quite a lot, so I know that the whole burnout thing is a real thing that you sort of really push on. Obviously not pushing on burnouts, but you know what I mean.
Prevention of burnout.
But you know, we've talked about the use of AI in terms of supporting the kind of stuff Lucy does with recipe development, understanding your consumer better. And just to say, Lucy, that chatbot we built you, don't worry, it's all completely secure. There's no data going out into the real world there. But the other side of it is how AI can help people in the food sector. So we're all massively pushed. We see it with our clients all the time, you know, trying to get 5 minutes with them. Please, can you just clarify the objectives? Because there's a lot of money in this research and you probably should. Helping that, like using it and understanding and embracing that technology. You know, one of the reasons that sort of I got interested in talking to Cara and bringing her on the team is because she said, if you have to do anything more than three times, you need to work out how to automate that. And I think there are so many, particularly in food and across the supply chain, there's so many things that we have to do again and again and again and again. You just think, oh, I just need a team of graduates to support me. this is what ChatGPT and AI and everything else can do for you. It is that team of people that can support you in doing the processes that you know, the tick box stuff, the filling in the, like Cara said, on the security with the police cams, the filling in the report. So if you could get to the stage where you're not the mug who's got to write the report every single time or tick the box or fill in the form or do your compliance, whatever, if you can just have it presented to you, is this right? Yes. And it's almost that reporting on by exception rather than having to do it all yourself.
You're so
and that's
right,
going to give you so much freedom.
Yeah, there is so much. And I think what you were saying has been so good having you on, Caro, to give that like tech perspective, because one of my frustrations in the food industry is I think we're not as good at taking things on as other industries. And I had a conversation about this saying, you know, there are tools that we can use that are very accessible that will make our lives so much better, because it's like having 10 people supporting
us. Tools that people are not using. I can't believe it when I say to people, like even in the one-to-one coaching I do, and they're like, oh, well, you know, like I've got a paper book, and then like I leave that at home and then I've forgotten everything I'm doing. You know, I'm like, oh my God, there's tools where you can have it on everything that you've got me. You know,
I would say don't beat yourself up. Having worked in a couple of other industries, and Karen's the same.
Education is
level.
My husband's in utilities, so you can imagine why there's a lot of clipboards there. So don't feel too bad about that. But food and drink and the supply chain element of it, and getting food from ground to mouth, there is so much that could be done. And I think there is the creativity and the innovation in the people working in the sector. Free that up, get them free of the process, free of the ticky box exercises, free of all of that. Let them be overseers and supervisors.
Particularly in development, because the development teams tend to, because we're interacting with the whole business, we tend to be the ones that are like racing about, chasing things. And it's like, there are ways to manage this better. There are tools to help us. And so, yeah, I mean, there's so much. And this has been so interesting. I just feel like we could, there's so much.
And with the tools and things like that, I think people are, and I see this a lot in where my work at the university, that one of the things that we do is upskill our staff in digital skills. And that's one of the roles that we kind of do. And people are often quite harsh on themselves in terms of actually how good you are at tech, because people always go, oh, I'm no good at tech. It's a common narrative. And they sit down, they open their email, they get on the internet, and they're like, oh, but this is just email. Well, in 1990, it didn't exist and you didn't use it, but now you can. And, you know, you can produce PowerPoints. At some point, you couldn't do that. And it's kind of when you have that almost internal monologue of, I am bad at this. Well, you are going to be bad at this. You don't know what you don't know. It takes time. You wouldn't expect to get in a car and never have driven it before and be able to drive it or fly a plane. And it does take sometimes a little bit of effort, like consciously, to engage with some of these. But conversely, the landscape is challenging. There's a lot of tools. It's difficult to know which one works for you or which one's going to work for you. But I would just say, like, you kind of give yourselves a break. Like, everyone who's listening, give yourselves a break. You're doing a really good job. You know, take real baby steps. If you're a guard, you know, it could be something that is not related to your work. Engage with ChatGPT about something like one of your passions. Ask it. I don't know much about art history, and I recently asked it to take me through the history of art history, producing an image at each time to show me the common style, but with a guinea pig as the main feature. And I learned so much. I learned, you know, I can now kind of recognize
this
different
is telling
art
me
style,
you've got capacity. Be careful.
This was about midnight. So.
I use it. I have used it to go, like, these are the things I've got in my fridge. What can, like,
I talk about as a workout planner. As I'm walking up to the gym, give me a workout for a X-year-old female, I'm not going to say my age, who is looking to lose weight, and I want a 30-minute workout focused on upper body. And boom, 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 it's there.
Yeah. And the, like I say, when you get to the more powerful versions of that are multimodal, all of a sudden you can talk to it. You can have phone call conversations if you use the iOS app and you have the Plus subscription. So I can stick my headphones in and basically walk around having a conversation with the AI and it replies in audio. You could take a picture of your fridge and go, this is what I've got. What can I?
You can do that on chat. You can do that on version 4.
So version 4 is multimodal. It accepts and generates images. It can run Python code, so it can produce spreadsheets for you, produce Word documents for you. All of those kind of things.
Yeah, so, I struggled with a pivot table.
I need to go and subscribe now.
I do now, actually.
I was like, when they said it was on ChatGPT, I was like, don't worry, I'm there. Subscription paid for.
Amy, I do actually have a referral code. Now okay, I didn't wear okay. Lucy signed
up. Oh, well, you need to send me the referral code.
Because I do this a lot.
Where it's going with food, I think it's going to, I mean, we did a great piece of work with the client that we work with on you, Lucy, and it's, I think, the next rounds of that are going to be really interesting. But imagine if you can give somebody who's not so much with, you know, food service and all of that, or potentially, but you can have an entire conversation with somebody using ChatGPT about their experience. You know, they can walk around a retailer with a pair of headphones in, talking about their experience, why they're making those choices of purchasing, and the sort of AI can talk back to them. Why did you do that? What, you know, it's like having somebody, normally that's really expensive to have a team of researchers follow people around. You know, you can even get into people's houses, ask them, how are you using that? What made you make that decision? Why did you, you know, things with MPD, you know, I was talking about one recently with a client about pizzas. The amount of people that don't preheat the oven before they put the pizza in and then wonder why it doesn't taste
soggy
very
bowl.
Nice.
Soggy
have it on ChatGPT. Why did you not preheat the oven for the recommended amount of time? You know, you can get into the detail of this and kind of go, okay, well, that's a barrier, preheating your oven. Maybe we can look at doing pizzas that perhaps, you know, we advise you to heat at this temperature, but it'll start cooking if you only get your oven to 140 rather than 180. So there's so much innovation that you can fit in there just by understanding your audience and knowing what is important to the most amount of people.
Yeah. Exciting times.
Very exciting. And Claire,
both me and Lucy being a little bit like, we're a bit scared. Not like massively scared, but we were ending it being like, we're quite excited by this whole thing.
I think that's the thing. Like most things, it's going to change the world in some good ways and some bad ways. And it's how we align that as people. It's going to almost poke at almost an existential crisis of what makes us human. It goes deeper than just like an AI, but the gains in medicine, for example, in drug discovery, it can process, and it's currently doing this right now, hundreds of thousands of combinations that would take researchers years. They're also using it for material generation, for example, in car batteries to isolate candidates. And it's things like that are really going to rapidly materials and things like that's rapidly going to change our world. But again, there is also the bad actors, because we have access to the APIs, and I like to think, I mean, I'm
we're
almost
responsible with it.
I would describe myself as anally ethical.
I do say yes, because there have been so many things where I've said to Gara, is this statistically significant? Could this be part of the marketing strategy here? Are we on to something? No, you cannot use that. The sample size isn't big enough, Claire. This is the statistically significant amounts you need to be able to say these things. I would not like to say.
It's important. It is important, because I think this is the, you know, sometimes marketing has a bit of a bad rep. And I think it's always best to be, you know, we can do both. We can be ethical marketers. You know, we can be ethical in what we do and give the clients a good service. And that also makes people come back, because, you know, we could do lots of things with AI that wouldn't be particularly ethical. And we're not doing that because we've made a decision. But That's not to say other parties across the board might not. And that's really where it's going to be challenging. And I'm not saying like, oh, we're going to make Terminator. But for example, 40% of code at the moment, coders have had AI a bit longer on something called GitHub, which is where we put all our code, is now AI produced content on Facebook. You might have seen pictures of like, my grandma knitted this giant cat, please appreciate and tell. I made it, my son made this with, it's all fake. None of it is real. It's all AI generated news articles. And that's because we have an attention economy where your attention is very, very valuable. And so, and again, then we end up with an internet that is kind of all AI generated, and we're really not certain what sources are from people, who's writing what, and that might not necessarily be a bad thing, but we just don't know yet.
I think human content will be real human, like certified human content
will be valuable.
Yeah, valuable.
Yeah.
Keep writing the blog post yourself. Use ChatGPT as a good framework, but I think
production is the meta at the moment. I think we work with AI. They support us to optimize the mundane and kind of let us focus on humanizing the exceptional, you know, that we can the things that need the human touch.
So Claire and I are talking at IFE on the 27th of March if you want to hear more about this topic.
Come and ask questions.
Come and ask questions. Guys, if people want to get hold of you, what is the best way to get in touch?
The best way would be hello@groundedresearch.co.uk or hello@englandmarketing.co.uk if the rebrand has gone terribly wrong.
Both mails will be live. Both of them will be live. Yeah. So.
But also, I mean, just grab us on LinkedIn. We're quite open for a chat. Mm-hmm. And it's just really, really the thing I want to get across is if you've got like a spark of an idea and you think, I'd love to just, what can I, I've got a question. What can AI help to get, how can the AI help me answer this question? Then just come and ask. And I think the beauty of it is, and where I really love doing it in food and drink research, is you can just be so creative with it. You know, we rocked you up a chatbot, Lucy, because we thought, actually, this would be really useful for what Lucy wants to do. Kara, I think, threw it together in a couple of hours, and I hope
now
it's
best
proving
friend.
Useful. Yeah, who needs husband and children anymore? You've got your chatbot to talk to.
Thank you so much. It's been really, really informative. And like I say, I'm feeling quite excited. I'm going to go and see how much it's going to cost me now.
I'll pop you that referral link.
Yeah, do that first.
Thanks so much for inviting us on.
All right.
Brilliant. You're very welcome. We'll see everybody next time.
See you next time.
Thank you for joining us today, and we hope that this has been useful to you. As ever, we would love it if you could rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. It really does help us reach and support more foodies out there.
We'd also love it if you'd come and join us in the Facebook group, the Over Food Sake community. And if you want to get in touch with us personally, Lucy is available for consultancy advice and training and can be found on LinkedIn as Lucy Wager.
And if you want to reach out to Amy for any one-to-one coaching, group facilitation or training, then contact her on LinkedIn at Amy Wilkinson Coach. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
See you next time.